So if a planet is just a planet of bacteria or some alien version of single-celled organisms that don't have complex structures, and importantly, that don't sequester their genes in a nucleus, it's very possible that the driving force of genetic change would be horizontal gene transfer rather than heredity.
Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Bethany Brookshire. And for once, yes, dear listener, it is aliens. Do you believe there's life out there? If you do, what do you think it looks like? Maybe it looks just like us, only gray and bald with very big eyes and only three fingers. Maybe it looks like a single-celled bacterium. Maybe it looks like something else entirely. No matter what, why do you think it looks the way it does? And what do you think that tells us about what types of life could be out there and about what it says about ourselves? If you've ever asked yourself these questions, you're not alone. And if you've never asked yourself these questions, don't worry, Jamie Green has. She's a science writer and the series editor of The Best American Science and Nature Writing. Her writing has appeared in outlets such as the New York Times Book Review, Slate, Popular Science, and many others. And her new book is called The Possibility of Life: Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Jamie, thank you so much for being here with us.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
I feel like a lot of people have wondered what is out there. I hope you can hear my capital O and T in out there. And I could see a book called The Possibility of Life just looking to science to answer that question. I could also see a book that looks only at sci-fi, like what humans have speculated about extraterrestrial life, to kind of examine how our views of aliens reflect us as a species and culturally. And you actually decided not to pick one angle or the other, but to combine the two. This book is half science and half sci-fi. And I was wondering what made you decide to take that approach.
I mean, basically, because a lot of those books already exist. There are lots of books about the possibility of life beyond Earth, the possibilities of alien life, that look at it as a scientific question, that look at what are the odds? Is it likely? Is it rare? Where would we find it? How would we find it? What would it be like? And they're all trying to answer it as a scientific question, which is a little tricky because science generally looks for answers, and we don't have any of these answers. So it's a lot of speculation. And the way that you make speculation scientific is by making it about odds and probabilities. And so when I was thinking that I wanted to write a book about aliens, I would go to the bookshelf in the bookstore, and I would go to the astronomy section, and I would see that these books already existed. And a lot of them were written by scientists. And, you know, you just read my bio. I'm not a scientist. I do not have a PhD. I audited an astronomy class in undergrad and took one undergrad astronomy class when I was in grad school. And like, that's it. So for a while, I had this drive to write about this subject because I wanted to learn more about it and spend time with it and explore it. But I didn't see a way to do that in a book that would like get published. And then, you know, years passed and I got the opportunity to write like a series of essays on a culture topic. And just like you know, I heard the capital O, capital T for out there. I hope you can hear the quotation marks around culture, because what I pitched the editor was, what if I write about aliens from a cultural lens? And this was totally me just like trying to find a loophole to write about what I wanted to write about. And God bless her, she said yes. So I wrote this series of essays. And when I sat down to write the one about putting scientific visions of aliens in conversation with sci-fi visions of aliens, I just felt like I could keep writing. Like, I think the word limit was supposed to be like 1500 or 2000 words. And I hit 2000, 2500, 3000, 3500. And I just felt like I could keep going and going. And that was when I was like, oh, I might have found my way in here.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that really draws us to kind of the possibility of life is this cultural angle. And, you know, sometimes to me, I know in my case, the odds of aliens seems very obvious sometimes. Like, of course, somewhere out there, there's like a little slime on a rock or something. Other times, I think about the odds of complex cells forming spontaneously, which is something you discuss in the book. And it just seems so implausible. And I was wondering, you know, you've written about the cultural side of aliens. Now you've written about kind of that and the scientific side. do you believe in aliens, for lack of a better phrase?
Yeah, I think I kind of agree with both things that you said. I think a lot of scientists agree too, that alien sludge is probably pretty common. I would not be surprised if there were alien versions of bacteria all over the place. But the leap from bacteria and archaea to complex cells, which is, you know, cells with internal structures, with a nucleus and things like that, organelles, that seems like it was a real fluke. And that's where I start not feeling as confident. And then when you start, you know, the more complex you want life to be, you know, the more you learn about it, the more lucky and fluky it seems. You know, like plants that live on land entirely depend on fungi around their roots, and their evolution entirely depended on that. So if your planet doesn't develop fungi, you don't get complex plants. Like, it's just all of these completely mind-boggling, unlikely events. But at the same time, it happened here, and it's mind-blowing how complex and amazing it is. And the universe is more creative than I am, and is more imaginative than I am, and than any of us are. And like, there's so much about life on Earth that we could never have imagined if we didn't see it in front of us. So I don't know, I guess, is my answer.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that kind of came through in the book was just how much complex life depends on itself in a kind of an ecological sense, right? You can't, we tend to see intelligent aliens, you know, walking around in Star Trek uniforms, like completely in our ecology, right?
Yeah.
Outside of any ecology that they might have. And the reality is that complex life is really complex. And, you know, thinking about how that ecology could come to be and the ways that that could take form is so mind-boggling. And I was wondering, one of the things that I found fascinating is that humans have actually kind of gone back and forth in their belief about whether or not the galaxy has other forms of life. And this goes way back in time. And I loved this. Like, I was wondering if you could kind of go through what sort of discoveries made aliens seem more possible. And
yeah.
Then what made our views kind of contract.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I loved learning about this too. And this idea that sort of like our worldview does dictate or constrain what we can imagine. So like, before Copernicus and Galileo, it was generally believed, like in Western science, that the Earth was the center of the solar system, and the solar system was the center of the universe. And if you think about it, like when you look at the sky and you don't have a telescope, you just have your eyes, when you look at a planet, it looks like a star. The only differences are that it doesn't twinkle and that it doesn't move with the sort of seeming dome of the sky. You know, like all the stars move together as if they were on one big dome circling us, but the planets that we can see, which is not all the planets, move independently of that. They sometimes move against it, you know, what we call retrograde motion. So the stars will be moving in one direction. This is me not knowing totally for sure whether they move left to right or right to left. Like I said, not an astronomer, but like the planet will be moving against that. And so, but we didn't know that the planets were worlds. We didn't know that the planets were planets just like the Earth is. They were little points in the sky. And so it wasn't until Copernicus and Galileo, where Copernicus is the one who figured out that the Earth is not the center of the solar system. The sun is the center of the solar system, and the Earth moves around it just like the other planets. And then Galileo, with his advances with telescopes, was able to look at the planets and see that they had phases just like the Earth or the moon, and realize that they were spheres and worlds just like Earth. And so that was a huge shift, because it opened up all of this real estate for imagination. So before that, people had imagined, or Before that, people had used the sun and the moon as settings for stories. These were usually like utopias or sort of like metaphorical, allegorical stories. But one, with the advent of telescopes and this totally new worldview, this totally new way of understanding the universe, soon people started writing stories that were set on the moon as if the moon was a world just like Earth. And I'm saying people because they weren't, you know, professional fiction writers. A lot of these stories written as novels or works of fiction were being written by scientists. Like Johannes Kepler wrote a book about a man's journey to the moon. But he was, you know, one of the most important scientists in history. And the line between scientist and fiction writer was very blurry, that you were, you know, the telling a fictional story about a man going to the moon was just as much an act of science as calculating the shape of the planet's orbits. You know, that this kind of imagination and this imaginative work and this work of imagining the possibilities of what might life be like on the moon, because we didn't at that point have sharp enough telescopes to see that it was lifeless, was all part of the same project of trying to understand the universe. And so then once telescopes did get better and we were able to see that the moon wasn't full of people and plants and water, that it was just barren rocks, then people shifted to the next planets. It was like, okay, now it's time to tell stories that use Mars as a setting. And this was still happening coupled with the evolving understanding of the planets. So once we, it's all sort of like these ways of shattering these early ideas that largely came to us from Aristotle, that the Earth is the center of the universe, that the spheres of the planets are perfect circles and their orbits are perfect circles because circles are perfect, right? So like Copernicus figured out that the Earth was not the center, but he still figured things out with circular orbits, which don't work. Like if you try to predict the movement of the planets with circular orbits, it doesn't work because they're on elliptical orbits. So there were still these big flaws in the model because we were attached to this idea of perfection. And then Kepler is the one who figured out that orbits are elliptical. They're not perfect circles. And then the next thing that had to be figured out was that the planets would be different. They wouldn't all be exactly the same. One of the reasons that it was possible to imagine life on other planets was because of this idea that if the planets were worlds just like Earth is, then they would be made of the same material, the same matter that Earth is. They would be made of Earth, well, you know, in to put it in old-fashioned terms, Earth and wind and fire and water, right? The sort of old idea of elements, which again comes from Aristotle, who just gave us all these bad ideas that took us, not bad ideas, but wrong ideas that took us millennia to break free of. And so the idea was, well, if the planets are planets just like, are worlds just like Earth, they would be made of the same material and life arose here. It was thought spontaneously. Why would there not be what is required to make life on other worlds? This also, sidebar, was like a huge kind of breaking from the teachings of the church. Although some scientists also were thinking, well, if God made life here, what would God not make life on all the other planets? You can figure out lots of ways to still fit it into whatever worldview you need to hold on to.
I also just love how many scientists would write fiction so many about this. It's like fan fiction.
Yeah.
Like writing fan fiction about scientific work, and it's adorable.
And it's like so fanciful. And it's clearly fiction. They're not presenting it as a scientific treatise, but they're also saying like, you know, oh, once upon a time, there was a man who had a dream and this is what he learned about the moon in that dream. Or here is a story about a man who is carried by a flock of geese to the moon. And here is what he saw, you know, and it just sort of keeps developing for hundreds and hundreds of years. The scientists were the fictional storytellers. The next big development that really opened up the possibilities was developing ideas of how planets form. And one of those ideas was that planets form out of the sort of leftover material after a star forms, which that is still basically our understanding of it, and that they would begin to coalesce farther out from the star, and then, you know, the sort of planet formation would work its way in, which meant that the planets farther out were older than the planets closer to the sun. This was also influenced by Darwin's ideas of evolution, the idea that planets would also have evolutionary trajectories and that the life on those planets would evolve. And so if a planet was older because it was farther out in the solar system, one way to extrapolate in your imaginings from that or in your scientific suppositions is that the life on those planets would have had more time to evolve and so would be more sophisticated, which is how we end up with the fictional trope of superior Martians either coming to Earth to take it over or coming to Earth to try to enlighten us. And so, I mean, that goes all the way up to like the turn of the 20th century with War of the Worlds. It's tracing back to Darwin and Laplace and his ideas of planetary formation and just sort of all of these scientific discoveries influencing and shaping and guiding how we imagine who might actually be out there and what kinds of stories we tell.
And of course, you know, as we expanded our ideas of kind of what the universe contained, we also kind of began to narrow down what was required, right, for life, for particularly signs of like alien intelligence. And so in the book, you go into some of the things that Frank Drake said we need to think about when we're searching for signs of alien intelligence. And it's so much stuff. I'm just boggled by how much stuff is required. And I was wondering if you could kind of go through some of the things that we know would probably have to happen for alien intelligence to be there.
I mean, it's funny that you say that this is like so much stuff, because one of the criticisms of the Drake equation, which is his way of like laying out these requirements, is that it skips a lot. So Frank Drake was one of the fathers of SETI, which is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, this sort of scientific field and project that started in the early 60s. And the Drake equation was an agenda setting exercise for him. There was a meeting of SETI practitioners. And so he like wrote this on the chalkboard of like, these are the things we should talk about, because these are the variables that determine how many technological civilizations might be out there from whom we could receive signals right now. So SETI was about like receiving signals or just, you know, catching the technological radio emissions of a civilization, and to figure out what to look for, to figure out if this endeavor is even worthwhile, you need to figure out, like, is it likely, is it not, how many civilizations might be out there that we could detect, and what would determine that. And so these are the variables that Drake included in his equation as like the things that would influence that number. So first is the rate at which stars form, because if stars are forming all the time, lots more places for planets. Then the next one is the fraction of stars that have planets. And what's wild is in 1960 or 61, almost all of these were unknowns. Now we know that most stars have planets, that if you look at any star in the sky, odds are it has a planet, not because we've directly detected all of those planets, but because we've detected so many planets around stars that we're just like, yeah, they're common. But Drake didn't even know that then. So the rate at which stars form, the fraction of stars that have planet, the average number of planets per star that could support life, the fraction of those planets that develop life, right? So you might have a nice little rocky planet with water, but it just doesn't ever develop life. Then the fraction of planets with life, where life develops intelligence. And then the fraction of intelligent civilizations that develop detectable technology. So you can see that at this point, almost all of these variables are fractions. And when you multiply a fraction by a fraction, you get a smaller fraction. So we're going, you know, from subsets to subsets to subsets, like what fraction of stars have planets, what fraction of planets that could develop life do develop life, all these little fractions getting smaller and smaller. And then the last variable is the average lifespan of a signaling civilization. So how long is a civilization producing signals that we could detect? Because if there's one civilization, but they are producing detectable signals for 10,000 years, odds are we're going to catch them in a good moment. But if the average signaling lifespan of a civilization is 100 years, they're just going to be a little blip. And if we don't happen to be looking during their very short lifespan, the odds have gotten smaller.
And of course, even then, if we tried to actually get there or send a signal back, even 10,000 years might not be long enough, depending on where we're at here.
Right. And, you know, that also, once we start talking about having a conversation, that also brings into the equation our lifespan. But there are stars that are more than 10,000 years away. So, you know, we might catch a signal, but by the time we catch it, that civilization either might not exist anymore or might have moved on to other kinds of technology that don't send radio waves.
And yeah, when we go back to thinking about whether there could be aliens, we're thinking on these long timescales, which means we also have to go kind of backward, right? Because we have to think about how life began, right? Began with DNA or possibly with RNA or possibly with metabolism.
Yeah, I mean, the question of the origin of life is not often one that comes up in discussions of the search for life elsewhere, because we don't know that the way that life began on Earth is necessarily the way that life would begin on another planet. But I felt like it was really important to include that in the book, because the study of the origin of life is in some ways a historical question. How did life begin on Earth? But it's also a question of how does life arise as a phenomenon, and like, what is life and what is our understanding of it? And those questions of whether it would always tend to arise as it did on Earth, would it share chemical structures? Does it require similar, does it require environments that are similar to the environment of the early Earth? That also guides our search. What kinds of planets are we paying attention to, and what kinds of life, you know, could we expect? Is all life going to have the same chemistry as life on Earth, that, you know, or should we be casting a much broader net?
And if it had completely different chemistry, how would we even know what it was when we saw it?
Right. Like, that's a really big challenge, because if we're talking about chemical detection, we don't have ways of, well, I guess we have some, but most of our methods of detecting the chemical signatures of life would require Earth-like life. And even if we're talking about testing soil samples from Mars or in the farther future from somewhere else, if the life is very chemically different, we might not have a way to detect it. And so there are some researchers who are working on much more agnostic ways of detecting life and of thinking about life as things other than familiar patterns of chemistry. But it's tough, because if you're not constraining yourself by the same constraints we have on Earth, you run the risk of having no constraints, and that's not a way to do a search either.
Yeah, that was my immediate thought. Was like, okay, well, then you just search for everything, right? Like, oh, look, this planet has iron.
Right, like, okay.
And another thing that I, you know, that really shocked me actually in this book, it was something I hadn't really thought about, is that when we think about alien life, we assume that it evolved by natural selection the same way that we did.
Yeah.
And scientists have pointed out that that doesn't necessarily hold true. Like, I wonder, it's very funny. I think scientists on Earth, you know, we cling to the idea of natural selection in part because it has been in the past, you know, such a fight to get other people to believe in it.
Yeah.
Now we feel like we're kind of stuck in it. But, you know, those scientists pointed out that evolution might not work the same everywhere.
Yeah, that blew my mind when I encountered that idea also. And I encountered that idea in a book called, I want to get the title right, Improbable Destinies, by an evolutionary biologist named Jonathan Losos. And one of the great things about writing a book is, so I was reading his book for research, and I hit this point where he says that life on another planet might not even evolve by natural selection. And I was like, what? And so then I emailed him and I said, hi, I'm writing a book and I just came across this idea in your book and it blew my mind. Can I interview you? It's really one of the pleasures of this where it's like, I wonder, who can I talk to about that? And basically what he said is that, so I had always assumed that that was like a law of life, life overall. And sure enough, like when scientists attempt to define life, which is a very fraught endeavor, one of the ways they often do it is by invoking Darwinian processes, by invoking natural selection. But Losos pointed out that natural selection in order, like requires a few, has a few requirements, like one of which is that there are species. And you wouldn't necessarily have to have species if you had life on another planet. Like thinking about extraterrestrial microbial sludge, right? So if a planet is just a planet of bacteria or some alien version of single-celled organisms that don't have complex structures and importantly that don't sequester their genes in a nucleus, it's very possible that the driving force of genetic change would be horizontal gene transfer rather than, you know, heredity. And we see this in bacteria and archaea on Earth as well, that things like antibiotic resistance is not transferred down by generation vertically, you know, from parent to offspring, parent to offspring. It's usually transmitted horizontally from bacteria to bacteria, even if they're not related to each other. So, you know, either they have let some DNA float into the, you know, it gets outside of their little cell and then someone else gobbles it up and incorporates it into their genome and suddenly picks up that skill. So it's sort of like if you were walking down the street and someone sneezed on you and you picked up some of their traits.
I hate it. Oh God, no, never say that again.
That is part of what lets bacteria and archaea be so chemically innovative. Like one of the really interesting things about them is that they have not changed structurally really at all in billions of years, but they change chemically so much more than multicellular organisms seem to. They, you know, can pick up important survival traits like antibiotic resistance just from the other organisms that are around them. And so in that case, the species, then like the boundaries between species get kind of blurry, right? Like if you can get genes from someone who's not in your direct line and who's not even in your species, like what really is the boundary of a species then? And so then the evolutionary competition isn't happening between species. It's not like this species has this trait and this species has that other trait and whoever has the more advantageous trait survives. Instead, what ends up happening is that the genes themselves are sort of winning or losing based on the sort of advantages that they confer. And so many, many, many kinds of bacteria have picked up antibiotic resistance. But what's really sort of winning out in the evolutionary battle, if we want to think about it that way, is the gene for antibiotic resistance rather than, you know, whatever species does or doesn't have it.
Yeah. And another thing that kind of made me think about the way we think about natural selection and evolution is not just in terms of, you know, maybe horizontal gene transfer and like actual genes themselves could win, but also the fact that when we think about passing our genes on, we always think of it happening through specialized cells, mm-hmm. like the eggs and sperm. It's not like a random cell in our arms. Right. And this limits us so much.
Yeah. And part of that is because our lives change our bodies, you know, but what's being transmitted to our offspring are just the cells in our gonads that are sequestered, that are protected, you know, and there are definitely evolutionary reasons for that. It's, you know, beyond the scope of my book, but one of the scientists I talked to about Origin of Life, actually, Nick Lane, has a book where he talks about like the evolutionary origins of sex and having sexes and all of that stuff. But it is possibly just one way for life to be. It's not necessarily the only way. And so there are just so many ways to imagine it. And it actually, you know, is really vividly imagined in one of the works of sci-fi that I talk about, the book In Dawn by Octavia Butler. She imagines a human meeting a race of aliens who, this is me sort of interpreting and reading between the lines, but they don't seem to evolve by natural selection or by competition. They seem to evolve, and especially in their intelligent era, once they're able to be sort of deliberate about this, by acquiring new genes. They meet other species and they get to know those species and their genomes and the various, you know, genes and abilities they have. And then they look at their own genome and say, oh, we need that skill. We need that ability. And they consider themselves traitors.
It's like, but they CRISPR themselves.
Yeah, totally, yeah. Totally. And they trade the material of themselves. And so they're able to offer a species, you know, whatever quality they have. And in return, they take this other new quality from the species, from the new species that they've met. And this also necessarily changes the way that they have sex and reproduce and the way that genes are transmitted to offspring. In this imagining, it's a much more deliberate process. It's a much more conscious process. And Butler suggests that human nature and the nature of life on Earth is hierarchical and competitive and antagonistic, possibly because of this way that our genes work, that because we are working in a realm of competitive evolution rather than acquisitive or collaborative or exchange evolution.
Yeah, and it's really also wild to think about convergence, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
You talk a bit about convergence, and there are a lot of scientists who think that not only would life on other planets evolve in a similar way, but that it would also select for something like us, something bipedal, something with thumbs. My personal favorite is that it would select for something with butt cheeks.
Right, because
and I was like, why do they think this? Why do they think, what's with thumbs and butt cheeks that are such a winning combination?
It's really hard to think outside of what we know. It's like try to imagine, you know, it's like trying to think without using language. It's really, really hard. And so in terms of imagining biology, you know, this is actually also something that comes from Losos's book, is that scientists have done the thought experiment of, if the dinosaurs didn't get wiped out, and if they had been allowed to keep evolving, if they had evolved intelligence, what would an intelligent dinosaur look like? Because it's not just intelligence in your brain. Your whole body is, you know, needs to change as you change your social structures and the way that you exist in the world, right? And like a lot of human evolution can be seen to have followed and preceded intelligence. And so this thought experiment is like, okay, well, if you're going to be intelligent, you want to be able to see the world with more focus, right? So your eyes can't be on the side of your head like a horse's. They need to be in the front like a human or a predator, because you need that sharp focus. And there are reasons you could think that you need to be upright. Part of it, I think, is for vocal communication. Part of it is to be able to see more clearly. So, okay. And then if you're going to be upright, that's why you need butt cheeks to be able to, you need really strong glutes to power that locomotion. And
I just love to think that maybe we're all just obsessed with butts. And we're like, I mean, you know what? It's going to have a butt.
It's going to have, let's just give it a butt, a little bit of flair. And you know, the idea that you need either that you, there are some arguments that having thumbs led to intelligence because it allowed us to engage more finely with the world. And there's a lot of chicken and egg, right? You know, like, did we Because thumbs really evolved for climbing and swinging on branches. But then once we had them, did that allow us to sort of get to know the world in a more refined way and get to build tools? And it sort of snowballs from there. But you follow that thought experiment and you end up with an intelligent dinosaur who looks a lot like a person. Yeah. And so, like, it's really hard to untangle. Am I imagining that this intelligent dinosaur looks like a person because personness is necessary for intelligence? Or am I just, you know, following a track that's already been well trodden? And we don't know. We just don't know. Because when we look around us on Earth, there are so many examples of convergence. There are so many examples of different evolutionary lineages solving nature's problems in the same way. You know, one of the best examples of this is eyes. Eyes with lenses have evolved on Earth so many different times. Our eyes and octopus eyes work very, very similarly. The lenses, like, it's the same structure, but they evolved totally independently. Our common ancestor with octopuses did not have these eyes. Or you look at wings, which have also evolved independently multiple times. There are also chemical things like, I mean, there's antibiotic resistance, but things like caffeine. Different plants have evolved the production of caffeine independently. Mm-hmm. Or look at sharks and dolphins. Their shapes are so similar and they got there totally independently. So then the question is, like, okay, if another planet, and this goes back to like the same sort of thinking that Kepler had about, like, well, if the moon has mountains, then there are going to be people to walk around there. Same thinking, if another planet has land and water and air, is the life on that planet going to evolve the same solutions? Is there a better solution to flying than wings? Is there a better solution to swimming than a sleek shark-shaped body? I don't know. Like, it's a like evolution on Earth took millions and millions of years to arrive at these solutions. Is that a honing process or is it a fluke?
That's no one knows. One of the things, it's very interesting. One of the things that comes through in this book is kind of the limits of human imagination about life. And one of the things I found especially hilarious is how much this book made me think about the limits of our imagination about pooping.
Yes, yes, yes. There's like the one mention is, there's like the mention of an alien anus and like, whether aliens need them or not.
Right. And, you know, because you think about Star Trek, because of course, and we have all these different species, which are all commingling. And of course, they all require human actors, which is the real reason they all look the same.
Right.
But somehow they all eat the same things. And presumably they all similarly go to the bathroom the same way. Like,
well, except
in Star Trek,
we don't know. So I am not a total Star Trek completist. I love it. I grew up on Next Generation. I've watched a lot of it, but I can't say for sure that we never see a toilet. But it is a really,
every time we see a toilet, we see a human.
Ah,
yeah.
So it's a really interesting question, because just like sharks and dolphins, we primarily know that the outsides of the humanoid aliens look the same. And sure enough, with sharks and dolphins, their exteriors look very similar, but we tend to see convergence in the part of the organism that interacts with its environment, that interacts with the thing that is driving that convergence. So with human and octopus eyes, that's the part of the body that is dealing with this electromagnetic radiation in the environment and figuring out what to do with it. Or with sharks and dolphins, it's the part of them that interacts with water. But when you look inside a shark or a dolphin, they're very, very different. You know, their organs are different. Sharks have gills. Dolphins have echolocation abilities. Even if you were to look inside a fin, the dolphin fin has like the remnants of hand or foot bones, whereas the shark fin just has like all these little cartilage spikes. So convergence is not complete. They did not converge into being the same kind of animal. They converged into having a similar exterior. And so then when you think about the humans and the Klingons and the Vulcans and the Romulans, there is the possibility that their insides are not convergent, that they solved problems of being an intelligent animal with their physicality in similar ways, that they have heads and arms and butt cheeks and mouths. But, and we see this with blood. So Klingons and Romulans and I think Vulcans have green blood and Klingons have like pink or purple, depending on if you're like watching old Star Trek or new Star Trek.
Vulcans are green. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
And like, yeah. And the Klingons in like old Star Trek were more pink and they've gotten more purple. So that is a little clue. And I'm sure that there exists in the Star Trek world or the sort of surrounding lore anatomy, you know, maybe someone has two hearts or things are in different places. But it is, I don't know, because we can see their mouths and we do know that they eat the same. They don't eat the same foods, but I think it's all generally.
They certainly drink the same alcohol.
Right. And it works on them the same, which also tells us some things about their brain chemistry.
Well, it tells you some things about their livers too.
Right. And you know, like humans don't necessarily enjoy Klingon cuisine, but they can eat it. But it's also important to remember for Star Trek that the humanoid aliens, the sort of most common races, are just a small slice of the world. You know, we are seeing the species that are in the Federation or at war with the Federation. We're seeing the species that have figured out how to work well together. But Star Trek does imagine lots of non-humanoid aliens as well. And like non-physical aliens, there are beings of pure light. There are space whales. There are, you know, all sorts of weird things that there's Q, who like exists beyond space and time with so much incomprehensible power that he's almost godlike, but he is just another alien. So, you know, it's not that Star Trek is saying all intelligent aliens would be humanoid, just like they are focusing on, you know, the ones that can be played by human actors, because that's what's available and what the special effects budget allows. That's also who we can tell stories about. We can tell stories about aliens who have a compatible worldview and have a compatible language and have a compatible experience of existence. But Star Trek does suggest that there are many kinds of alien intelligence that, you know, we wouldn't be able to have a conversation with.
Well, it's too late. I have now decided that there's an alien species out there that extrudes its waste through its pores and then uses the waste to protect itself from electromagnetic radiation from its sun.
I mean, why not?
Coat.
Why not?
So, you know, we were just talking about Star Trek. You seed references to science fiction throughout this book. There's Star Trek, there's Avatar, there's Ursula Le Guin, there's Octavia Butler. You don't have Star Wars in there.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, how did you end up kind of choosing the science fiction examples that you used?
Part of it is writing about the science fiction that has been most formative to me. So like, I grew up watching Star Trek The Next Generation. I grew up reading Le Guin. I grew up reading Madeleine L'Engle. And there are also books in here that like I read as an adult that were really just sort of revelatory to me, and that then I thought would be really good in the book. You know, like I had read The Sparrow and Semiosis and The Fifth Season before starting work on this book. But then I also was looking for sci-fi that offered interesting imaginings, interesting versions of things. And so I wanted to bring in examples that either fit in cool ways with the science or challenged the science in cool ways that were sort of like in conversation with the science. And so, I mean, the reason that Star Wars isn't in there is honestly because like, I don't think of Star Wars as sci-fi. I think of Star Wars as fantasy that takes place in space.
Don't come for us, listeners. Don't do it.
It's knights and swords and magical creatures who happen to be aliens. Like Star Wars is not interested in Star Wars is interested in aliens because they are cool and varied and different, but it didn't fit for me. If I had grown up loving Star Wars, like Don't come for us. I like Star Wars. Maybe it would have fit in there, but it just didn't feel important to me in terms of how I think about the possibilities of alien life, whereas Star Trek is like about that and uses it as part of its project for like challenging our empathy and challenging the, you know, our idea of self and other and like in-group and out-group and imagining this like almost propaganda version of a post-scarcity, post-poverty, post-war human future. You know, it's like this is about looking for kinship and community and a federation of aliens. It's like it's really essential to the themes of it. Whereas the aliens in Star Wars, the fact that they're aliens, I don't think really has anything to do with it.
Well, and that's one of the things that I really liked about this book is how much you point out that our concept of aliens is very much about what we want and about who we are, right? And who we want to be. And I was wondering, what do you think are kind of the main things that our ideas of aliens tell us about ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, a lot. So the thing I always think of in terms of this idea is contact, because Carl Sagan like very much wanted us to find aliens and wanted us to get a signal and wanted us to join this galactic community because he thought that humanity needed it. And a lot of the early SETI practitioners like Sagan and Jill Tarter looked at their work as like giving humanity that something needed. Sagan often talked about us being in what he called a moment of like adolescence. The humanity had just gotten into, and you know, this was in the 70s and 80s, but I think it still applies today, that humanity had just gotten to this position where we had this new technological power, this ability to destroy ourselves. He was talking about nuclear weapons, but you know, pick your poison. There are lots of ways we could do it now. And he likened it to a teenager who'd just gotten the keys to the family car. They are not mature enough yet for that power, but they have it. And he thought that finding extraterrestrial life, other intelligent life, which would reasonably be more advanced than us, would help us get through that adolescence safely. Just like you don't give a teenager the keys to the car and then never talk to them again. You give them lessons, you give them guidance, you show them that many teenagers have come before them and acted responsibly and survived into adulthood, and you inspire them with that, you know, which is a bit of a stretch of the metaphor, but that was what Sagan hoped would happen. And sure enough, in the novel of Contact and in the movie, we are given this sense of hope. We are given this sense that not only have other civilizations made it through this tough spot in development, but that we are cared about by them. And this is something, you know, that we see pretty often, that when humans meet super advanced aliens, it's either war, like in Independence Day, or it's a kind of enlightenment. It's a kind of, you know, they care about us, they reflect us back to ourselves. Like the alien in Contact says things like, you know, you're an interesting species, you have so much love and so many dreams, but you haven't figured out X, Y, and Z. You know, we want this external perspective on ourselves so that we can understand how we fit into the context of other species, and so that we feel like someone is rooting for us and wants us to succeed and might be able to give us the tools to help us.
Yeah, that was something interesting that I noticed. I mean, about Contact and about so many other First Contact books, is that we really want another species out there to look at us and say, you are interesting.
Yeah.
You are worthy. And it actually made me think a little bit of Douglas Adams and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where mm-hmm. other species look at us and they don't like go to war with us, which is another way of kind of declaring someone worthy to
yeah.
humans, a worthy opponent. They don't look at us and go, oh, you're interesting. They look at us and go, we're creating a new hyperspace bypass.
Yeah.
You are in the way. Sorry about that. We're not really. You're not very interesting.
Yeah, you're just a dime a dozen.
And this was really interesting to me. I was wondering, did you ever think about comparing our desires to meet aliens with things like our desire for religion, like our desire to see something out there that gives us meaning and makes us the best versions of ourselves, right? Because even when, you know, we have an Independence Day scenario, for example, that's the best versions of ourselves. It takes the best of humanity to fight the worthy fight and win. Or, you know, we make contact with aliens that are much more advanced than us. And it's like, oh, they're going to bring us to this higher version of ourselves. It's like the old versus the New Testament God. And I was wondering, do you ever kind of think of our desire to see aliens as kind of this, as related to religion at all?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we trace it back to the Renaissance in Europe, we see, to put it really, really broadly, science starting to supplant religion in terms of driving our worldview. But it doesn't necessarily supply meaning in the same way. You have to work a little harder. Like, religion is like, here is some meaning, here's what it means, whereas science is like, here's how it works, do with that what you will. And I definitely think that a lot of science fiction is about trying to restore that sense of meaning through science. And again, this is a huge thing in Contact, that the alien that Ellie Arroway, the main character, meets is very much an angelic presence in her life. I mean, he takes the form of her deceased father, right? Like, that's a big one. And he offers her a broader cosmic context within which to see the earth. And that is a big thing that religion offers, not just, you know, morality and a sense of what's going to happen after we die, but a context for humanity to exist within, and a meaningful context, not just a factual context. And science doesn't as easily supply that. It says, okay, here's where the Earth is in the galaxy, but it doesn't say anything about how the galaxy feels about that, because the galaxy doesn't feel anything about that. And so science fiction adds that feeling back in. It adds that sense of context. So it's not anymore humanity within the hierarchy of God and the many layers of angels and animals and plants and whatever. It's humanity within the context of advanced civilizations and less advanced civilizations, and, you know, humanity understanding ourselves by comparing ourselves to other aliens, you know. So, okay, Vulcans are very logical and Klingons are very warlike, and then where do we fit in on that spectrum? Things like that. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why we love having aliens tell us what they see in us, because we are the only example of intelligent life that we know. But to have an advanced alien who's familiar with the whole landscape say, ah, okay, you all are hierarchical, or you all are full of love, or very imaginative. Like, sci-fi is just full of aliens saying, ah, humanity is like this. And we go, oh, okay, thank you, thank you. Both because it is important information and because it's really meaningful to have someone care about that. And so we get this trope of these very advanced aliens who come to us something like angels, either with a message or a warning or just another presence in the cosmos that we don't otherwise have.
What's really interesting, though, is it also kind of shows us the limits of our imagination about who we are, by also showing us the limits of our imagination of who aliens are. And I mean, we talked about that biologically, but also culturally, mm-hmm. right? One of the things you call out, for example, is how many sci-fi futures that we imagine are based on colonization.
Oh, yeah.
Like, often that's very literally, like, books are about moon colonies, or we colonize a new planet. But also, often we meet another species because they're colonizing.
Yeah.
Which, and I was wondering why you think that is. Like, why do we assume that, of course, any species that attains intelligence must want to expand?
I mean, part of that in the stories of, oh, no, they want to colonize us, is white Western authors writing out of a place of guilt and sort of imagining the worst thing that could happen is for someone to come colonize you, just like our ancestors did to other people on Earth, right? Yeah. You also get into really interesting visions of colonization in sci-fi writing by non-white, non-Western authors, but that's like sort of a sidebar. I think that colonization is a big common trope in sci-fi, partly because that's one way to get the aliens to us. It's one way to explain why they would be here visiting us. But it's also just us assuming that the way that history went on Earth is the way that history would go on other worlds and is the way that history will continue to go on Earth. And that is a very narrow view, because it's not that all cultures and civilizations on Earth colonized. It's just a few of them. It happens to be the ones that either directly or in a sense of legacy led to the culture that you and I are speaking within right now, right? Like, but that's not every culture and that's not every civilization on Earth. It's just kind of the loudest ones. And I do think that it is somewhat a narrow view to assume that the dominant culture that's the driving force on other worlds would be the same as it is here. But another reason that we tend to assume or talk about life on other worlds being technological, being wanting to spread through the galaxy, is because those are the civilizations that we could find. So if we come back to science, it's not that every intelligent civilization will necessarily detect radio waves or build megastructures around their stars. Like, some of them might just be sitting around writing poetry, and that might be how their civilizations develop. But we're not going to be able to find the poets. We're going to be able to find the colonists and the technologists and the ones who continue to expand. You know, if you think of technology in the simplest way as the use of resources to do stuff, those are the worlds that we're going to be able to find. So while the poets are lovely to think about, and I hope they are out there, that's not who scientists are writing their papers about, because that's not who they can build any technology to detect.
And it also kind of made me ask myself, you know, we talked a little bit about colonization. We've talked about kind of the comparison between our desires to meet aliens and religion and how we want aliens to save us. And I just wonder, why do we want aliens? Like, why do we want there to be aliens? So many people want this so badly.
Yeah.
And not, whether or not they would save us or attack us or just like try to communicate with us or not, why do we want this? Why do we want there to be life elsewhere?
I mean, that is sort of one of the big questions of the book, and I don't know that I have an answer even. Scientifically, it's easy to answer. It's that a lot of scientific work is very cobbled by the fact, hobbled. A lot of scientific work is very hobbled by the fact that we only have one example of life. You know, we have lots of different kinds of life on Earth, but all life on Earth shares a common ancestor. So this is one example. And so when you're trying to think about the different ways that life might be on other planets, the ways that life might evolve, trying to figure out fundamentally what life is, you really can't extrapolate from one example. So finding more examples would be hugely meaningful for science. We also feel like it would be hugely meaningful for humanity. And I think part of that is that we feel very alone on Earth. We see ourselves as separate from all other life on Earth. Whether that's correct or not, whether there is other intelligence, whether we could ever communicate with it. You know, I write about dolphins for a section in the book because they're a really interesting example of, we have other intelligent life on Earth, and we have been, I discovered, way less able to understand them and communicate with them than you might think from just sort of like general culture. And they're weird. They're very different from us. They live in water, you know, like they live in a three-dimensional world where, you know, like they don't, it's just all the different ways that their environment has made them so different from us. It's just like really
profound. And so then how could we possibly hope to communicate with anyone else? But so like, we're surrounded by life on Earth and we can't communicate with any of it. We can't say, oh, you too, you're like this also. And we want that. We want to know the other ways that you can be a person. We want to know the other possibilities for life because we do want that context within which we can understand ourselves, not to be able to say like, okay, we're the imaginative ones, or not to be told that we're important, but just to sort of triangulate again. So it's both comparison and community, I think. And we want to know what the universe is for. And it doesn't really need to be for anything, but that feels very lonely. It feels like, what's the point? Why are we here? But if there's life everywhere, that gives us a kind, even if it's, you know, not anyone, any, you know, no one did it on purpose. But then it's like, oh, the universe is for life. And so then we're not just like a weird hiccup. We are part of what the universe does. You know, the universe is physics and matter. And when that matter gets complex enough, it turns into chemistry. And when that chemistry gets complex enough, maybe it turns into life. And so maybe we're not a weird fluke. Maybe we're just as much a part of the universe as, you know, an atom or a galaxy or the sun is. And I think that figuring that out, you know, it doesn't replace religion. It's not the same thing as religion because it's not directed, but I think that it still can feel very meaningful.
Yeah, you remind me a lot of something you noted from Andrean in the book, that she says encountering aliens would give us self-esteem.
Yeah.
and not to say it would give us high self-esteem or low self-esteem, but it would kind of give us self-concept.
Yeah, because she calls it human self-esteem. So it's a self-esteem for all of humanity. And so the way she sees it, the search for alien life, the creation of meaningful messages to send out into the cosmos so that someone might find it, any kind of collective accomplishment that is from humanity as a whole is a way of having human self-esteem. And she says that we need that because, like, we're stuck. We are, because if you think about it, like, our conception of what humanity is that we are bad. We are destroying the planet. We are fighting wars. We are perpetuating capitalism and harms and inequality. And Druyan's point of view is that, like, this would be an opportunity to increase our self-esteem. And it's not that doing good things gives you good self-esteem, but having better self-esteem helps you do better things because you're telling a different story about yourself. You're telling yourself, deep down inside, I'm good, not, you know, oh, humanity is a cancer on the planet. It's just, it's a way of shifting the view so that you can, so that then your actions start to embody that new sense of yourself.
Well, I don't know that the self-esteem that we got if we encountered aliens would actually be all that great. But Jamie, thank you so much for taking us to the stars.
Thank you. It's been really wonderful talking to you.
If you'd like to learn more about Jamie Green and her book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos, we've got those links available for you at scienceforthepeople.ca. That's right. We're from Canada, and you'll pry our Tim Hortons from our cold, dead hands. You can subscribe to the show across all podcasting apps and follow us on places like Twitter and Facebook. And if you like the show, it would help us out hugely if you left us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you like us even more than that, we have a Patreon page where you can support our hardworking producers and editors with a monthly or a one-time donation. Help to keep the podcast going. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Science for the People.
Science for the People is listener-supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. We get help with special projects from K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Anika Hazra, Marion Kilgour, and me, Rochelle Saunders.